accession number 22065, reel 6.
This is Dennis Avey, and we're now on reel 6, Dennis. And I think you were telling me that after this time in the mines, you were sent to Auschwitz. But could I just ask you about the mine work? Were you the only British POW doing this?
There were four others, as I recollect. Mark you, I only had virtually days there. Well, 10 days at the outside. And this problem that they had, these poor fellows getting shot, and we thought subsequently that we would be because we were in the same line. And whether or not they immediately had words and said, well, this is something wrong, we'll get rid of the British POWs. And that's the reason why I was whipped out of there. I personally was whipped out of there and sent to Auschwitz. E711.
So, could I ask you now in detail, in as much detail as you can remember,
yes,
about Auschwitz? First of all, how did you travel to Auschwitz?
By cattle truck. As the norm. No method of sanitation. Nothing at all. Just a literary cattle truck. I think they used to say H of L rather, and how many in France, what did they say? 8 men and 10 horses or something like that. Exactly the same cattle truck, only very much bolted, what have you.
Did you have any idea where you were going?
No idea whatsoever.
And who were you with? Who were you sent with?
Where from?
From the mining place to Auschwitz.
I was sent with some civilians, the Polish civilians, and also, no, they weren't only Polish. There were some French people there as well. And I've got a feeling they were volunteers. They wore, I think they called them chasseurs. Chasseurs, they used to wear the beret, and they very, very much became one of sympathizers with the German regime. And I went with them. Now, I left, I was taken off at Auschwitz station and taken up in a vehicle to E711. That was about 2 miles away from Ige Farben, or rather E.G. Farben industry, which we called Buna, which was rubber. Now this, there were about 150 British POWs there, for one reason or another. I never went into it at all, but I thought I'd landed in Fairyland. It was wonderful barracks, first-class barracks, running water, bunk beds, blankets, everything, blankets, no sheets, blankets, and that was first class. And it was a big area in which we could exercise and what have you. And I thought, God, there's something wrong here, something very much wrong here. Because I'd had a little bit of treatment, you know.
Yes,
and then they used to walk us every day, then, this 2 miles, to Ige Farben, to work. And it wasn't all that bad. Then we were there for about a month or something like that. And suddenly everything turned around. Apparently, this camp we were at belonged to the Hitlerjungen, or previously to the Hitlerjungen, the Hitler Youth. And they had been encampment there. Now they moved us from this camp up to E715 at Monowitz. That was immediately adjacent to Ige Farben. And all we had to do, we're right on the, virtually the, near enough, on the gates of Egefarben. And all we had to do is just march out at first light into Egefarben to a different bows and work. But there, the situation was different. There was no lavatories, there were just, not holes in the ground, there was a, you know, basic lavatory. There were just cold water, and that's it. And the barracks were adequate. Adequate, what I say, adequate. And that was it. And the treatment in the barracks was reasonable to a point that we never got pushed around inside, except on certain parades, you know, and when they wanted to make announcements. And unfortunately, it didn't do too much good because our chappies were very, 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 very much, and they gave them a lot of strife, you know, one way and t'other. And of course, this put their backs up. This is the unfortunate thing about it. And we used to work every day in Egefarben, Egefarben, for 10 hours, at least 10 hours a day, at least 10 hours a day.
What were you doing?
Well, we were assigned to different bows, in other words, different contractors. There's no end of contract. It's a huge concern. It was about, I would say, 3 miles square, surrounded by double apron fences, 15 foot high, electric fences in between that, and posterns on every 100 meters with machine guns, up on elevated covered platforms all around. And on top of that, you had the Hitlerjungen, the Waffen-SS, the Wehrmacht, the Arbeitsdienst, and no end of civilian control there, no end of it. And yet, paradoxically, I found out I was well, I think I was very well educated to be a con man there. That's where I got my education. It's amazing. Well, the first job we had was to working with pipes, carrying damn great pipes and flanges and God knows what. And we had to put these in and just overruled by one civilian engineer. And the guards were very few on the ground those days. And engineering, my background, well, I was able to do, which we did, and organized a hell of a lot of sabotage. Tremendous amount. Tremendous. When I say a tremendous amount, I doubt whether Egefarben could ever start again. Anyway, the situation was that I got moved to different abteilungs, different departments with different contractors. And to give you the idea of sabotage, I had to work on a gasometer, constructing a gasometer. Well, this engineer was a cocky so-and-so. He was a very good engineer, boss man, very German. And we used to lift these plates up and bolt them in and progressively go up. Big gasometer. And then I was given the job of riveting. Very good, excellent. I thought, well, this is marvellous. I knew a thing about rivets as well. And what I used to do, used to have a holder on at the back, rivets come through. And of course the rivet, you've got to hit the main brace of the rivet. and then pinch it over. Snap, make a snap over it. But if you make the snap, if you impinge first very lightly, then make the snap, it doesn't expand the rivet inside. The snap just makes the closure. And although it initially held pressure at the time, a few weeks into that pressure, it would start leaking, and I'd have to take the devilish, the whole lot down. It wouldn't have held. Do you understand what I mean? Anyway, he didn't say much to us, but he was a show-off, you know. And we finished this thing, and I was in the base of it at the test, making sure that the test was all right, you know. And then we got outside, and he looked up at the top. Now, this is where it came in. It's German, you know. And he then went up the ladder, right to the top. These RSJs, as you know, right to the top, and RSCs all the way round. That is channel iron all the way around, two lines of channel iron all the way around, this big gasometer. And he pointed up there and said something or other. And we were looking at him, you know, civilians as well. He climbed this ladder and walked round the top. Walked round the top. And when he came down, I said to him, "Well, what'd you find up there?" He said, "No, nothing. I just always go around." I said, "Funny thing." I said, "I spotted something up there." And he said, "What have you spotted?" I said, "I'll show you." I didn't go up the ladder. I can do a lot with RSJs, roll steel joists. I can climb them hand over fist, put my knee inside the channel and the foot outside very easily. And I went right to the top of this gasometer. He was standing below, and I walked round the top of it. Just, and I said, "How's that? That's the British way of doing things." I said, "It looked pretty good. What I saw, I thought, is okay." And he never spoke to me ever again. And we never saw him ever again after that. I was showing off, actually. But I wasn't showing off in my true sense. I was trying to show him that although he's worked all his life on steelwork and has the ability to walk around on RSCs, also can British people as well, albeit that they were a bit underfed at that time.
Can you give me other examples of sabotage?
Oh, I could get you a lot. Loose flanges, welding, bad welding. We made a key. They used to do oxyacetylene welding there. And I made a key during my stay there. Now, keys in those days, you put a key into an oxyacetylene cylinder and turned it, and you couldn't get the key out because a little stud used to go round and lock it. Well, I made a key so you could turn the oxygen or acetylene open, and it would open the valve and get the key out. And no end of, I didn't open the acetylene, I opened every oxygen bottle I could get hold of. Just put a slightly open, so after two or three days, the whole lot of bottles, which were hundreds of them, they didn't have any oxygen. And they couldn't work the acetylene, they couldn't weld without the acetylene. Oh, well, there's a right to do over that, but unfortunately, other people got the blame. Then, there was a girl, a Ukrainian girl. She used to work for an engineer, one of the engineers. And she more or less, although she was a slave worker in the sense of the word, they all brought from Ukraine, she was very much anti-German. And she used to talk to me quite a bit and bring me an awful lot of food. Fantastic. And more particularly, information on what was happening, what machinery they were bringing in, and Lord knows what. And as a result of that, you know, we could pinpoint it and work on, look at the machines and find out, you know, the vulnerable part, the Achilles heel of them, and work on that. But the great thing was not to break anything there and then, or not to sabotage, to break, you know, to make immediate breakdown. The whole secret of it, that you could do damage, but damage that wouldn't be immediately perceptible. It would be in the long term. And lots of things like that on gauges and, oh, tremendous amount of things. And the only thing, the bad thing that I was worked on was in a trench laying cables, heavy cables. And that's where I got into trouble. It was winter. It was about 8 foot down, and I used to work with the political prisoners as well, the stripies alongside us. And the roll had stopped for some unknown reason, and we stood up looking, and there was one of the stripies up there, and of course, one of the SS Veltwebels approached this chap immediately above me, and immediately addressed the Waffen-SS, these political prisoners, had to take the hat off straight away, stand at attention, and that's it. And he stood at attention telling this Veltwebel something, and he hit him right across the face and knocked him straight into a pit. And as he fell, so the roll of the cable rolled over him, killed him. And I remonstrated with this, like an idiot, with this Veltwebel. And he didn't say a word. He jumped down in the pit where I was and hit me straight across the face with this Luger. And that's where I got me. And nothing was said, nothing at all. Nothing at all was said. By the same rule, one of our chaps was shot dead, because he was ordered to go up on a gantry to work on pipe work, and unfortunately it was a number of degrees below zero. It was freezing, and it wasn't safe on the steelwork at all, and he refused to go up, and he was shot there and then. One of the Grafiders took his pistol out and shot him there and then. I saw it.
That was right. A British prisoner of war.
Pardon?
And he was a British prisoner of war.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely, yeah. But, and that's the sort of thing that used to go on. But my trouble at Auschwitz, and I think as a result of that, part of me died there. Without any doubt at all. You were underridden by this ghastly 24-hour stench from the ovens and the chimneys. 24 hours a day, and a sickly smell. And I can still taste it, you know, that to this day. You're under it 24 hours a day, and it's going on the whole time. And that's underwritten by that. And then the dreadful situation of the political prisoners. It was ghastly, absolutely ghastly. I don't know how we got through it in one sense, but like I said a short time ago, you develop a veneer, if you like, that exorcises certain things out and brings other things in. And in this way, you can go on. But I subsequently thought about this many, many times. When I was on the desert, and when chaps get killed alongside you, It hurts, but the unhappy thought subconsciously, thank God it wasn't me. That's the terrifying thought that still lives with you. And this goes on to this sort of syndrome with these political prisoners. They were in a dreadful state. And I saw terrible, terrible ill-treatment, terrible ill-treatment of them. There were about four a day I witnessed that were killed or died, and the cart used to pick them up when we were going back. And God knows. Every day this occurs. But having said that, I don't know. We didn't do much about it. We couldn't do much about it. I used to encourage some of them to try and escape or do something about it. But again, they were so brainwashed. But more interestingly, I think it was in a reference to something I know about tauromachy, bullfighting. I've studied it from the historical point of view, and I've studied all the techniques of it. I don't agree with it, but I've studied it. And when a bull gets in a certain position, it's what they call a quirenthia. It's a position that the bull thinks is safe in. And this, I thought, to the thing, I think, that was basically the thought of these stripies. They thought they were safe to a point. They knew that they were going in the gas chamber eventually, but they couldn't do a thing about it because they thought, at that time, they were safe. Now, a lot of things happened in there. To give you an idea, when I talked about a con man, I used to work with Stripies and three of other chappies in one of the buildings, which were building filters, big, big, tremendous filters. And it was a bit much. And I must admit, our overseers weren't all that good. The guards weren't all that brilliant. There was only one to about 200 men inside the factory, obviously. And I thought, blow this for a tail. We're out in the cold all day. We don't get a chance of warmth or anything. And I organized this, and I went very, very carefully over this bower, because these contractors have big areas which they, again, build barbed wire around with gates on the front, and they keep all their equipment inside there, the pipes, the gas cylinders, everything. And they had these, what we call boodies, the little wooden huts. I thought, blow this for a lark, and I went in there. I organized this with each other. I told them exactly what I was doing. They knew me in this bow. And I knew there was a booty in there that was empty. And we went in there and we took it to pieces, put it on a truck, and heaved it about half a mile away and built it half a mile away. And you know, that was never found out. Now, with all the security there, no one ever questioned it. And we were very meticulous taking this down, and no one challenged us. Now, that is the remarkable thing. You can do something in front of these people. Now, I've had to understand the German psyche to stay alive. And in this regard, I proved it time and time and time again. It's extraordinary, you know. And
so did you use that for shelter then?
Pardon?
Did you use this little boonie?
Booty.
Booty, yes. Did you use it for shelter?
Oh, absolutely. We even made a fireplace, some chimney, the lot. Oh, there was no holding up. It was extraordinary. It was a paradox as such, you know. But there it was, and this girl, Pauline, I've got a photograph of her. She helped me tremendously, that girl. She gave me a tremendous amount of information, and I even got to talk to the big engineer. I forget his name offhand. He was an older man. And he was very interested in me. I used to have a lot of conversation with him. And in that regard, I got a lot of dispensation. It was remarkable. Not that I wanted it, but I got it. And I was getting all this marvellous information on what was coming in and where it was coming and things like that.
He would have been a German engineer, would he?
Oh, absolutely.
The big German engineer.
Oh, yes. And engineer, they're big men over there. They're engineers completely. They're the bosses of two or three Abteilungs, you know. They're the design people as well. And
what was your opinion of the efficiency of this place, you know, as an engineer yourself, apart from the fact, of course, that you were sabotaging it, but you know what they were actually, what they had set up at Auschwitz.
The German idea, they're very thorough. They have a straight line. They're not flexible. This is the great thing about it. This is the reason why we are so paradoxically strong. Because we are so flexible. It's like a chimney. If you build a chimney 400 feet and it's stark like that, really stark, it's the most dangerous thing you can ever have. It has to be flexible in a wind. And it's like riding a punch, if you like. You ride a punch. If it's given you and you ride with it, it's less effective. And this is the reason why we were so strong with the Germans. Against the German. They're so absolutely A, B, C, D, and not a twain shall meet, you know, that sort of philosophy. And this is where we had them beat. They were good to a point, but as I say, again, they lacked the flexibility to be strong. In that case, they were very weak. And they used to do things absolutely dead right, but nothing left or right or anything else would do.
What were they actually manufacturing there? What were they? What was the end product?
Well, the end product was making rubber from coal and gas and dyes, eventually dyes and paints.
And paints?
Paints, yeah. That was all I could find out that they were doing. In point of fact, it was said that they manufactured initially the Zylon A and B, or was it Zylon or Zyklon? Zyklon, I think. But I never got the truth of that. But definitely they were manufacturing that. But where we were in that area, they never manufactured, and I think that the whole place never started up at all. If they had started up, it would have just come down in pieces without any doubt at all. And really, the cables. Now, one would have thought you could have cut the cables. Now, that wasn't the thing to do. That wasn't the thing to do because they test cables. And they test the insulation of them subsequent to burying them. What we did was to lay the cable surreptitiously on very, very sharp pieces of rock and material that there bound to be a flexibility sometime, and that rock would ostensibly go through the insulation. And there were huge main cables as well. That sort of thing.